Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to our video series, Studio 471. I'm speaking with Patrick Garrity, who's a cybersecurity researcher and also vice president of marketing at Nucleus Security. Thanks a lot for joining me, Patrick.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I always love to talk phones.
So we're going to talk a lot about patch management and vulnerability management. But first, why don't you tell me a bit about Nucleus Security and yourself?
Yeah, so we work with large enterprises with their vulnerability management programs. And when I say that, right, we provide a service where we help organizations aggregate and consolidate all their vulnerability and asset data, and then help them build automations and prioritize what things need to get fixed and drive that to the people that actually need to fix them, which is pretty cool. And then, you know, I do a lot of different things, but one of the things, you know, I really enjoy doing is, you know, security research on the vulnerability side and helping build data visualizations to share with people.
Excellent. Excellent. And so there's been a lot going on with exploitation this year. You know, Mandy put out a report in its MTrends report, and it said that vulnerability exploitation was the top initial access vector, and it was followed by phishing and credential theft. What have you seen? What have you observed at Nucleus, how this is affecting enterprises?
Yeah, so actually, you know, take a step back. I originally, before Nucleus, worked in multi-factor authentication. So I worked for a company called Duo Security starting in 2012. And one of the things I think people need to realize is, like, up until about 2021, if you read the like MTrends report, like credential compromise was pretty much it. Like, that's how people got into environments. With a few exceptions, right, where an exploit here or there would be involved. But mostly exploitation was used once people would get into the network, right? Things like, I think, Bluekeep would be a good example, maybe some SMB signing. But the real reality is it wasn't until recently that mass exploitation was happening on the initial attack vector. And that's only happened in the last 2 or 3, maybe 4 years. And so, like, everyone's caught by surprise suddenly in relation to this, because, like, they weren't really looking at exploitation as being the initial attack vector in most cases.
Yeah. And so that's put a renewed emphasis on vulnerability management and patching. And, you know, a couple of years ago, CISA launched the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, which just crossed its 1,000th vulnerability, although I think there's at least five more added today. And so this requires, you know, U.S. federal government agencies to patch these exploited vulnerabilities within a, you know, very tight timeframes. You know, what have you seen as far as, like, the effect of, like, the KEV on organizations that are outside the government? Has this helped improve or, I guess, speed up their patching timeframes?
Well, yeah, I think number one is, before the KEV was released, there really wasn't any, like, publicly available vulnerability exploitation data. So, like, this is the first time where there's essentially threat intelligence on the vulnerability side that's accessible to anyone. So it's kind of cool to see the government opening up, like, you know, their threat intelligence. And at first, everyone's like, this is a really small list and the data is kind of, like, inconsistent. But the reality is like, that was, I think when they released, it was like 400 vulns, let's say. And some were, like, really old, but that's because it was an internal list used by the government. And then they decided to then make this into an externally facing thing and hold federal agencies accountable. But, like, they made it accessible to everyone. And then as time has gone by, you know, the data in it has matured to where it's much more, much better. You know, timeliness is okay, but, like, it's real things that people have in their environment that they should absolutely fix without question, right?
Yes. And this is kind of like the big red flag that you need to fix this absolutely immediately, because threat actors are actually using it. And it looks like there's been terrific results. There was a recent story that said federal agencies have seen a 72% decrease in the percentage of KEVs that are exposed for more than 45 days. So that's a pretty remarkable statistic, I think.
Yeah. And I think like that's one thing is the government is just trying to move the needle on like base controls, right? To ensure, there's more and better security practices. And so I think that's helped on the federal side. And then commercial tools quickly incorporated this into the vulnerability management side, I think in the commercial as well. So you have organizations looking at the KEV that don't even have to comply with CISA requirements, now leveraging using the same information that maybe all they were using before is something like CVSS, which doesn't consider a threat. So it's really, really good in that like it helps organizations at least get to a minimum baseline from a vulnerability management program perspective.
And so do you see that product integration then with the KEV then? Is that kind of also just that sort of like extra nudge or I guess maybe sort of extra emphasis that, hey, well, the federal government thinks this is pretty serious to patch because threat actors are using it. So maybe we should do it too. Because it seems to me that security teams have a tough time sometimes making the argument to patch, right? It's like, how do you argue the downtime? How do you argue, how much resources is going to take? Do you think that this is making that argument or that, I guess, that point a little bit easier?
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier. Hey, like CISA, the U.S. government has this vulnerability on a list because it's being exploited or has been exploited. Like definitive source, reputable source, like we should probably do something about it. Like that's hard to debate that, you shouldn't do something. And there are always like mitigating controls as well you can consider. But the other thing is anything on the KEV has to have a patch or mitigation. So like it's actionable. Like that's a really important part of it too. Beyond just saying like it's actively being exploited. Cause there are a lot of cases where like you have exploitation, but you can't do anything about it patch wise. So I think like, it is a really actionable list that people can quickly take action on and increase their security baseline.
And recently, you've done some really interesting research into the KEV, and I see part of it is hanging behind you. You stood in front of the White House with that colorful, should we call it a towel, or is it a poster, or what actually?
Yeah, that's a towel. Yeah, it's right here.
tell me about it.
The whole idea behind it was, and I have stickers too, so you can see there, but the whole idea behind it was, I wanted to visualize the KEV in a way that it kind of was a piece of artwork. And I knew that it was coming up on 1,000 Vulns. So I coordinated during Black Hat. It's a little bit early. I think we were at like 980 Vulns, let's say, but I did it anyway. And essentially it's the top vendors, right, that are in the CISA KEV. Now there's incredible bias when you look at things from a vendor perspective, like, the big thing is blue, it's Microsoft, but also like that's a collection of vulns from Microsoft for the last like 25 years. And to be honest, Microsoft has a very good vulnerability disclosure program. And so I think like it's very easy for people to jump to the conclusion of like Microsoft is exploited bad, when in reality, I think there's also factors that you got to consider of like their technology is pervasive. They have lots of different products. It's been around for a long time. So I think that was some of the conversations that kind of grew from it. And then I took some inspiration. I wanted to make it look like a piece of artwork. So Piet Mondrian, who's a famous Dutch artist, paints windmills and then also the tiles. So you can see them in like the MoMA, I think. I was like, I'm going to leverage those colors and the tiles. And then faintly in the background, you can kind of see I also put CISA's logo in there.
Yes.
To layer on. And so, I was interested when I did this, like the week before Black Hat, then I reached out to CISA and I was like, hey, I'm doing this piece of artwork. I actually reached out to Jen Easterly and I was like, I also have a few questions I want to talk to you about interview wise. So like it opened up the opportunity to get to kind of showcase my work, but also drive awareness of CISA KEV and then get to meet with, Jen and talk about some of the great programs that CISA has going on in relation to vulnerability management.
And so that became quite popular. Like on LinkedIn, it was, you know, liked by hundreds of people. What do you think made the difference between, I guess, seeing it visually versus, I guess, seeing a list of vulnerabilities? And how do you think that impacts how people think and perceive their own risk?
Yeah. So I think like market timing is part of what's going on with some of my work, right? So the reality is most people have seen vulns in spreadsheets from a Tenable or Qualys or Rapid7 scanner. They get an Excel spreadsheet in their mail and it like, it's just data. So I think like one of the things looking at the Kev2 was like, how do we make this so you can kind of like touch it and look at it and like it can drive emotion and feeling. So like data visualization is a great way to do it. And there's a few people that have been doing vuln data visualization for a while, but it's mainly highly technical, right? And more scientific oriented type of visualization. So like Scientia is an amazing organization that focuses on like real tangible things. So for me, I'm like, well, I want to pull the heartstrings of things that people can relate to that may not even be in vulnerability management. And I want to educate as broadly as I can. And so part of it is it's like, you know, taking down into really simple concepts that someone can see. And what I found too is like just a vendor name is a good example. So like, you know, I remember at Black Hat, I ran into Gary Hayslip, and I gave him a sticker and he's like, no way, I just use this in front of my board. And you know what he said? He goes, here's the deal. I could put this in front of a board and say, hey, you know, all these vendors, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, and on and on. And the board members are like, yeah. So I want you guys to know this is CISA, the US government's known exploited vulnerabilities list. So all these technologies we have in the environment, like they have exploits or vulnerabilities that are actively being exploited. And we need to actually build a program to ensure that like, we're putting the right security controls in place and patch management so that we protect our environment. So I think like that's the type of stuff from a conversation perspective. When he told me that, I was just like, no way, that's awesome. Like that's the purpose behind a lot of the work that I do is helping broaden education on the importance of vulnerability, you know, good vulnerability management practices and patch management practices.
And it's also just like not the number of vulnerabilities by vendor. It's also the ones that are picked by threat actors. You know, Mandy put out they did a study of zero-day vulnerabilities just recently. They looked at 246 vulnerabilities that were exploited in 2021 and 2022. And they found, you know, that Microsoft, Apple, and Google comprised numerically most of them, but a lot of the ones that were actually exploited, really embraced by threat actors, were kind of like lower down, right? There may be like vendors in there of like firewall vendors, for instance, or, you know, SSL, VPN that get exploited that ransomware groups particularly really like, right? And it represents almost a third of your attack surface. So when you look at that chart, right, it's like you just don't want people to look at the big squares though, right? Because it's kind of like there's a whole spectrum, right?
Well, yeah, but I also think there's some things to be said around like, yeah, you should, like, hopefully you have good Microsoft Windows patch management in place. Like, don't forget about your Exchange servers, your Azure, like, your Office, all that stuff. But like, that's more or less, I think, important to me. Like even categorizing it a different way, it's like, oh, you have network devices, you have operating systems, you have applications, you have phone systems, like all these different things are being exploited. And you need to think about what your patch management processes are for all these. And then you also need to look at like, how are you assessing what vulnerabilities are in that environment as well? Which is really, really important. And then you mentioned 0 days and ransomware. It's like, yeah, I think that's an interesting thing where it's like getting on top of those things very fast and quick is important. So like having capacity to be able to go and do that. In some cases, like you're already owned, like Barracuda, we saw that. I think MoveIt, Progress MoveIt as well. Like there's going to be cases where like, there's little you can do other than call your IR team and you know, have a IR organization in place to kind of help and support you. But by and far, it's like trying to do the best you can with the basics, right? so that you're able to tackle things effectively, proactively, is a, you know, great way to look at things.
I was going to ask you too about the rapid response capabilities, because that's one of the things that you recommend is companies that are, at least, you know, organizations that are mature enough, have that capacity to be able to move quickly when there's kind of like a Kaseya type situation or a move it type situation. I mean, do you find, I guess my question is, do you find that that capability is at this sort of high level of maturity, or is that capable for smaller, I guess, enterprises or organizations?
I think it is, but like by and far, I think sometimes people over index on the like the 0 days, and it's like, well, if you have good patch management in place, like you might actually have time on a 0 day to get a patch in place, because like that's new. Most actors are actually exploiting older vulnerabilities because that stuff hasn't gone patched. And so I think there's a balance where it's like, yes, you should consider having rapid response for high risk vulnerabilities that are new, but don't go chasing that if you haven't even patched all the vulnerabilities in your environment that are exploitable or high risk, right? So I think there's really a fine balance between that. And I do think as you go down market, like the smaller the organization, like considering whether you outsource some of that function is a real reality as well. If you don't have the resources, and then like if you do have a 0 day, for instance, that you discover externally facing, it's been there a while, you might even want to engage an IR team just to make sure that nobody actually used that exploit, because like just because you patch that, and I think we saw that with Citrix with like a tool someone put out, maybe Mandiant, where you could see if someone was actually still in your environment, but just because your patch doesn't mean that actor is out. And so these are real realities that you have to think about as it relates to how you respond to 0 days and other exploited vulnerabilities.
Yeah, to your point about patching older vulnerabilities, I was struck by when CISA published the 2022 top routinely exploited vulnerabilities. And I think it was a top 12, not a top 10, but I think it was six or seven of those were not from 2022. You know, they were all,
most of them aren't.
2018, 2003 from 2021, actually five from 2021. Those were the Microsoft Exchange ones from around March of 2021, proxy shell. So, at Intel 471, we see a lot of mileage coming out of, old stuff that should have been patched, right?
I think another good one is I went back and looked at, and I do a lot of this research where I'm like, let me look at 2022, 2021. 2020, and like there's one vulnerability with Fortinet that's on all three lists from all, you know, from all 3 years, the same one from like 2019. And so that, you know, that leaves me with some questions as well, like, hey, what's going on here, Fortinet? Like, is there a way to patch that stuff, or did people just put this stuff on the internet and forget about it, right? Like, I think those are real realities a lot of the times. So, you know, that's where, like, you know, looking at data over time to see like what's being exploited. But similarly, I think the Exchange servers, like those are multi-year on the list, I think, too many of them. And the reality is like, I've experienced it firsthand, even on the IR side, is like, people don't patch these things. Actors use those. They're grabbing the email. They're sitting on there. They're kind of living on the land on these Exchange servers a lot of times. And you know, they can go upwards of years without being patched. And the other thing is people think they're patched because they patched the operating system, and they didn't patch the application itself. So there, you know, there's all these intricacies that you have to consider as it relates to vulnerability exploitation and patch management, that can be a real challenge.
I want to ask you about ransomware too. Have you seen a change in vulnerability management and patch management programs and in this age of ransomware, like over the last 3 or 4 years? What have you observed?
Well, I don't know that I've seen anything myself, and that's not something I've completely studied, other than I think if like an exploit, which a lot of times, you know, commercial threat intelligence like Intel 471 is going to provide you additional visibility into like what's being used with ransomware, what's being used by different threat actors. Like that intel allows you to understand what things really need to get fixed and prioritized. Cause like if there's a threat actor associated with it, then like you should probably get on it. And then I think there's also the aspect of like, is it being targeted by my industry? But these are considerations on how much time you have. By and far, like what we're seeing is an acceleration and quickness of how quickly people are getting to these exploits, right? And doing them at a mass scale. So I think like, yeah, ransomware, because it's effective and the new techniques and tactics of like data exfiltration with ransom is just put things on a whole nother level for organizations. You know, really, really from that perspective. And I think there's a lot of different motives. I think like even a lot of ransomware is backed by state actors. So just because it's ransomware doesn't mean like their only incentive is the financial payment. Like, I think there's real activity going on where there's incentives by nation states to disrupt, you know, democracy and businesses and, you know, to them, that's a win without having to roll tanks or missiles or other types of things on the cyber warfare side. So, yeah, I think we've seen that become really, really much, much more aggressive just over the last couple of years.
Yeah. 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 We kind of look at exploitation from the threat actor's side of like, are threat actors discussing a particular vulnerability and then kind of map it through its phases. So, you know, we'll see threat actors discussing kind of a vulnerability that's become public. You know, we'll see like a threat actor solicit for, does anybody have any proof of concept code? And, you know, once that proof of concept code is developed, we'll kind of track it if it becomes, you know, weaponized. Like, has it gone further? Like, is it ready for like an exploit pack or an exploit kit? Yeah. And then finally, has it been kind of productized in that? Is it in, you know, ready for Metasploit where like lower skilled threat actors you know, can use it. I mean, I could give an example of one that really kind of stands out. This was a vulnerability in Citrix ShareFile, which is an managed file transfer software. So we know that this stuff is a favorite of the Russian, you know, cybercrime group known as KLOP. And so this was a unauthenticated remote compromise vulnerability. It got added to KEV on the 16th of August of this year. And, you know, we saw people talking about this, threat actors talking about it back in June. And we saw one individual who was actually, you know, offering to put money in an escrow account to buy POC code for this. And so, you know, threat actors say a lot of things, right? So, but this person was actually a, you know, had a reputation of being reliable. And so we viewed that as like, okay, this person's ready to put Bitcoin and an escrow for when POC. So that's like another tick of like, okay, this vulnerability looks like one that they're very, very interested. So, you know, sometimes we can really see, you know, based on threat actor discussions, that's how we do our vulnerability intelligence dashboard. It's really driven by that adversary intelligence.
And that's what's really important is it's like the more you can get ahead and the more intelligence you can gain, right? Around like the possibility of something, you know, turning to being exploited, all those indicators allow you to actually be a lot more proactive, which is really, really good. And that's what I think people overlook on the commercial threat intelligence side is like KEV is a tip of the iceberg, like in relation to the depth of what you can gain from commercial threat intelligence. And then the other thing is that's really important is like defensibility. So like, when you're making a risk exception, it's really good to have a different commercial intelligence sources, because then I actually have defensible evidence to say like, hey, look, I looked in these different commercial feeds and KEV and other places and like there was no evidence. So we decided to risk accept it. Now, maybe that changes over time, right? And you reassess the risk. But I think that's a really important thing to be able to have, because if you end up in a scenario with the SEC or, you know, some of these other areas where then you get hit really hard, at least you have proof to say, like, we made the right decision with the information that we had, right? So I think that's another way that commercial threat intelligence is really important and as far as how it can be used.
I was going to ask you about improvements to Kev too, because people are already discussing about, oh, there's too much, you know, maybe there's too many vulnerabilities on it. This is too much for smaller shops to handle. Or there's also discussions of like what types of supplementary information might be useful for people. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, that was like, so we created a SysaKev dashboard at Nucleus, which enriched with EPSS, CVSS, and I think Gray Noise Honeypot stuff, right? And so like we always have been like, and I think other people, like, we want more information just to understand like about these vulnerabilities. What's interesting is they did just add a column on the catalog called known to be used in ransomware campaigns. However, none of the vulnerabilities have a tick or a checkbox or anything there yet. So I'm kind of curious to see like what words they use or what things they put in that column, or how many things they actually demonstrate or show are known to be used in ransomware campaigns. And I was like, oh, they should just like make an acronym, KTBUIRC. Sorry.
Like everybody's going to go,
worst
what is
acronym
that?
Ever. Yeah. It was just really interesting, like many words in a column that I found. But yeah, I'm excited to see that. And then, you know, I think there's possibility of them adding additional stuff or even going to different levels with this. So I just think, like, considering it's an open source threat intelligence feed, it's, you know, incredibly valuable for people that maybe don't, you know, have the money for commercial threat intelligence or are a really small business to at least like have a starting point, right? Because we see that all the time. Like, I see small businesses that have KEVs, and it's like, well, at least if they do that, it's a really, like, 1,000 vulns out of 200,000, like, most organizations are only going to have a handful. And if you have more than a handful, like, you probably have some work to do as well.
And it brings up a good point. It's interesting that they've added that column specifically for ransomware. But what do you think is the most useful threat intelligence around vulnerabilities?
Well, I think there, like, so there's the, you know, you look at like what's openly available and then, you know, the commercial side. So, you know, start with what you have is what I would say. It's like most tools are going to have KEV in there. You also have the exploit prediction scoring system, which like has a probability of exploitation over the next 30 days. High scores. And like a lot of people are like, what's a high score? Well, like, hey, 1 out of 100 vulnerabilities are going to be exploited with 1% probability, right? So like probably lower than you think, like, but you could start with a 90 percentile. And if you have those and then work your way down and move further down. So EPSS is a pretty effective place to start as well. So like those are two open standards that you can leverage and use, which is great. And then I would say like beyond that, starting to look at commercial threat intelligence feeds. And depending on the maturity of your organization, the risk tolerance, like you're probably going to want multiple if your risk tolerance is really low, right? Because the reality is like more intelligence is going to give you more things to look at that are higher risk. Like there's no silver bullet. And so, you know, that's where I think it's like, yeah, start with where you're at, what you have, and then build upon that. You know, it's really my perspective when you're looking at how to incorporate threat intelligence into your vulnerability management program.
I'm glad you brought out the EPSS. Like, how do you see organizations using that? Is that kind of like a pre-KEV warning? And do you see organizations, I guess, acting on you know, EPSS scores that are, you know, quite high?
Yeah, so we have seen that EPSS can be an indicator of something landing on the KEV. That's not always the case. You know, so I think something to keep in mind, like KEV is, at some point there was known exploitation, whereas EPSSs were predicting it's going to be exploited in the next 30 days. So, you know, a lot of times you'll have KEVs that have a low EPSS score and people are like, what's going on? And it's like, well, the probability of a threat actor using that is low. So that could be how you prioritize KEVs even. But I do think, relatively speaking, like, go grab your vuln data and look at what's achievable for you today from an EPSS score perspective. Like, start at the top and work your way down is a good way, and set a threshold and say, we're going to keep within this threshold. Like, that's a pretty good way to use it. I've also seen, like, I don't know if you guys use it, but like, I do find that a lot of even commercial threat intelligence feeds use it as an indicator to do research on like high risk potential vulns. And that's a big part of it as well in commercial threat intelligence, is companies like Intel Force, everyone have teams of people that are analyzing each vulnerability, right? And then they're building out like details and information, so like you don't have to do all that research yourself. So it's, you know, it's really interesting just like some of the different ways that people are leveraging and using the EPSS model for vulnerability prioritization, but also vulnerability research and intelligence.
Great. And with that, thank you very much, Patrick, for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's been fun. Thanks so much.